Today, we're bringing you the story of a John Doe whose body goes unidentified for decades. Who was he? And how did he die?
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
Our story begins in the spring of 1981 in Bethlehem, New York, a town of more than 25,000 surrounded by farms and beautiful rolling hills. The bitter cold days of winter had passed, and the local farmers were finally able to get back to work in their fields. On April 3rd of that year, Frank Vadney, the owner of a horse farm on the edge of town, was out surveying his property. His granddaughter, Lynn Dente, talks about that day.
Every spring, my grandfather would go out. He was out checking the fence line and happened to be in the way back corner of our field, was looking in a small section of the woods and saw 2 feet sticking up and a man lying down. And that's where they found him. And then he contacted the police.
Officers, detectives, and the coroner were dispatched to the scene. The area was densely wooded, and the partially decomposed body was clothed, and a few papers lay scattered nearby. Aside from the body and the papers, nothing else was found at the scene. There was no wallet, nothing to identify the man. The body was in an advanced state of decomposition, so there was no apparent cause of death. At that time, investigators weren't sure just what they had. The body was transported to the morgue for autopsy. And so began the investigation into the man with no name. At the time, police believed the man had been dead since January. We spoke with Bethlehem Police Detective Adam Hornick about the autopsy, which revealed no obvious signs of gunshot wounds or fractures. But because of the state of decomposition, no internal organs remained, so the cause of death was ruled undetermined. Their John Doe didn't match any missing persons in the area. And detectives knew that before they could figure out how the man died, they needed to figure out who he was. Today we've got so much technology at our fingertips, and everyone's heard of DNA. But in 1981, DNA technology was just emerging. Most police crime labs had not yet gotten into DNA analysis, and there was no centralized DNA database. In fact, the FBI's Combined DNA Index System, known as CODIS, didn't exist until 1998, 17 years after the discovery of this body. Police chased down every possible lead, but they found nothing. The papers found near the body led nowhere. The only thing left to do at that point was to enter the case into state and national databases as unidentified human remains. The case went cold. Records indicate that in 1993, the fingerprints of the dead man were resubmitted to the state for analysis, with no matches. Then, in 1996, the case was resubmitted to a national database. With no other apparent leads, the case went cold again, and years passed. Until October 2013, police officer Adam Hornick of the Bethlehem Police Department had just been promoted to detective sergeant when he was approached by another sergeant, asking about one of their old computer entries for a John Doe. Neither of them was familiar with the case, and no one else on the department of 42 sworn police officers had been working in 1981. In fact, Hornick would have been in kindergarten at the time. Here's Adam Hornick.
The first time I even heard this case existed was in October of 2013, and the administrative sergeant came to me. One of my jobs as the detective sergeant was to validate wanted persons, missing persons, unidentified persons in the state and national database. So he handed me this and he goes, is this record still active? And I looked at him and I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And he told me a little about it. He's like, oh, this is a body that was found up on the Vadney farm, kind of near the high school back in the early 80s. So right away, I was fascinated with the case, to be honest. And I'm like, how have I never seen his case file? I've been a detective for 7 years. I was our evidence and property custodian at the time. And I'm like, we have no evidence on this case, but the portal entry very specifically said that the jaws were available, which piqued my interest right away. And I'm like, that's not possible. I've been through the evidence room, you know, dozens of times. There's nothing in the inventory. Then the search came on for a case file. I'm like, where is this case file? I want to know more about it right away. Well, one reason was to validate the record. I had to make sure it's still an active record. And two, my interest was piqued.
Sergeant Hornick went looking for the case file. He had no idea what he'd be in for. He hit his first obstacle when he discovered that the town's record storage area had flooded years before on two occasions, which resulted in many records being damaged or lost. There was no file on his John Doe.
I went personally through the old files and had many members assist on separate occasions, working as a team and working separately to make sure we didn't miss anything. So we literally had, when I say we had two sheets of paper, it was just a printout of the portal entry of the unidentified individual. That did have a clothing description, you know, that described the type of shirt, pants, and the moccasins, but it didn't have all those details of what was found near the body, how the body was found, and what had been done. We had a good summary of the body. There was an approximate height, and the age approximation was 30 years. The decedent was 30 to 60 years old. While that's good, it's not, as we know. And there was also the dental chart, and every information was included in the clothing description. There was a generic outline of what that scene looked like, but that was about it.
At this point, the odds of finding the identity of this John Doe weren't good, and Sergeant Hornet could have just given up, but he didn't. He knew that this could be someone's son, father, or brother. Whoever this was, Hornick was determined to do whatever he could to identify the man. He started to recreate the file from scratch. He began with the NCIC computer entry, that's the National Crime Information Center, used by police for sharing bulletins with other police departments about crimes, wanted and missing persons, stolen vehicles, and in matters like this, unidentified human remains.
So in the next few months, I started working on coming up with how can I recreate this file? Where do these records exist? Well, the only thing I had was from DCJS, so I reached out to them.
DCJS is the Division of Criminal Justice Services in New York State. And back in 1981, they maintained paper copies of the NCIC entries. Sergeant Hornick was starting to make headway.
But they, lo and behold, had, it was about 14 or 15 pages of stuff that included a copy of the original incident report, which was completed on a typewriter. It had 1.5 pages of notes, like the detective notes that they would actually take in the first 2 days after the investigation. But it did include a sketch of the area, a sketch of the body. And on that sketch, it had a list of the documents that were found near the body. It had a photocopy of that fingerprint card.
According to the computer record, Bethlehem police noted in 1981 that they had jawbones available for identification. Sergeant Hornick, who, as you'll remember, was also in charge of the evidence room for the department, hits obstacle number 2. He searched high and low for the bones, but came up empty. Then, Hornick encounters obstacle number 3. There was no one still on the force who was around in 1981, so he reached out to retired members of the department to assemble whatever knowledge they could provide for the case, and he continued his investigation. In 2015, Hornick was promoted to commander. He could have handed off the case, but he held on to it. At this point, he owned it.
So now I had an incident report. I had names. I had a real location. I had members of the department that were involved in the case. Some of those members that were involved have since passed. Some of them were still alive but retired. So I was able to reach out to them and talk to them and ask questions. Hey, what do you remember about this case? And that was actually very helpful just, you know, for the beginning to get to understand, working from now 6 or 7 sheets of paper and even figure out exactly where the body was, you know, why they thought this, what made them think the time frame for the death and everything. So like rebuilding that file was huge. This time, 2013 and 2014, were very busy times in our detective office. We had a lot of large scale cases going on. So this was kind of something that got worked in when I had a short down period of time, or if I was working a holiday or staying late on my own to work on this. One of the other places that was very, very helpful in having some case records was the county coroner's office. So I reached out to the chief coroner, told him about it, and it was actually his father was the coroner at the time, did the case, and he was able to quickly find the records, send me the coroner's report, which included a full autopsy report.
That coroner's report included some preliminary notes from the medical examiner, along with a case number used by the ME, 81-078. This number was now stuck in his head and would become important later on.
So between those dental charts, the DCJS had the incident reports. So now I really had something. I had all the paperwork from the coroner's office, their initial intake sheet of the body, and that actually pointed out what dentist had done the forensic dental work at the time. So I really had some substance to go on.
Commander Adam Hornick's investigation was gathering steam. His next step was to check their John Doe record against others in the national database known as NAMIS, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. NAMIS helps law enforcement agencies to connect the dots when investigating long-term missing persons.
And in June of 2015, we were comfortable enough that we entered the case into NAMIS. So just being able in that less than 2 years to get the case into NAMIS was a big step.
The NAMIS entry resulted in at least 9 or 10 hits. Commander Hornick investigated and eliminated every single one. Some wondered why he didn't just run the dental records.
Everybody was saying in the office, well, just run the dental records. And everybody doesn't realize it's not like fingerprints, where if you have an unknown fingerprint, you put it in, it could tell you who it is. The dental records, you need to know who the person is you're comparing it to.
He kept thinking about those dental records and the computer entry that said bones were available. He needed to find those bones.
So the dental paperwork that DCJS had forwarded us listed the name of the dentist that had completed it.
Knowing that the jaw bones were not in police evidence, Commander Hornick started tracking down the dentist who made the charts for the original missing persons report. And this is where he encounters obstacle number 4.
So when I looked that up online, it didn't exist anymore. I was able to determine quickly through a couple phone calls with investigators up there that the dentist office actually still was there, but it was on a different road now.
So Hornick had found the dentist's office. And when he asked for the doctor who produced the dental charts for John Doe, he hits obstacle number 5.
I realized that the dentist had retired, and I found him in the state of Arizona. He basically had said that he did dozens and dozens of cases for law enforcement back in the early 80s, but I sold the business 15 years or more ago and wasn't associated with it anymore when he moved out to Arizona.
Hornick won't take no for an answer, and he begins the next step in his investigation. The dentist was retired, but the original dental office was still there. Linda Hayner was working at the office when Adam Hornick called.
So one day I just decided to call up to the business and say, basically, hey, I have a really weird question for you. Are there any records left of this? And lo and behold, I get a lady who worked there back in the 80s, was still there, said, yes, there's still actually a banker's box in the basement. In that box, there's boxes of bones.
He was very hesitant because he said, I know I'm going to ask you a question that you probably won't have any information about, but as soon as he explained that he was looking for old cases, I knew exactly what he was talking about. So I knew that there were cases that were in a box downstairs, and they had been there for years. Some of the numbers on the boxes didn't pertain to what was in the box, so I was trying to sort out what was a correct number. He gave me a number, and I just kept looking for that particular number, and bingo, we hit it.
And I just remembered that number, 81-78, and when the lady read it, I'm like, that's my bones. And she's like, how do you know? And I'm like, well, I'll show you when I get up there. I'm on my way.
I was as surprised as he was. That particular case that he was working on ended up in our box. I think all the stars were aligned, and they just happened to work out that day.
With the jawbones back in the hands of law enforcement, Hornick now wondered if he might be able to get a DNA analysis. But first things first, and obstacle number 6, he had to confirm that these were in fact the bones of his John Doe.
So we're now talking 36 years that these bones have been out of police and law enforcement custody, because the autopsy paperwork indicates that they brought them there 2 or 3 days after the deceased's body was found. So here we are, June of 2017, and I was like, we have the bones. And I emphasize the, because the question is, knowing how DNA works, I can't just submit these to the lab. The lab's never going to accept these based on me matching the numbers, the coroner's case numbers. We have to do something to prove that those are actually our bones. They were in amazing shape. All the teeth were still intact on both jaws. You know, 2017, this is just when New York State is passing the DNA laws, where you can finally start using familial DNA in certain cases. So I'm keeping an outside hope that that's possible. And really then my goal in the department with everything else going on was to set this case up for somebody to solve someday. I have enough pieces, even though we're missing that big case file, we've reproduced a lot.
So we're still at 2017, and enlisting the assistance of famed forensic odontologist Lowell Levine, Hornick asked the doctor to compare the bones to the dental charts from the original autopsy.
He came to our station, looked at the bones, did a complete dental chart for the bones that were in front of us. And I said to him, I said, well, now can you compare them and tell me if it's the same? And he said, well, you can actually do it. Get the chart. So we got the chart from the 1981 case, put it next to it, and everything was 100% exact match. So at that point, I got to be honest, that was like a really, really good feeling. Even though it was 4 years, we went from not even knowing this case existed to we now have bones and there's a chance we could get DNA off this.
Commander Hornick sent the jawbones to a few DNA labs, including the University of Texas, which had been doing a lot of work on unidentified human remains. A partial DNA string was identified. Hornick's investigation was gaining speed, but he's about to hit obstacle number 7. It's now October of 2018, and Hornick sent a request to the state of New York to start the process for familial DNA on the bones. But then came an answer he didn't expect. The case was not eligible. Hornick explained that the law and regulations in New York State at the time only allowed the use of familial DNA for items left at a crime scene. The body of an unknown deceased did not qualify. Hornick's next strategy was a press conference, which happened in December of 2019. It resulted in some tips, but none of those leads panned out. But that media push focused attention on the state law that did not permit the use of familial DNA in cases of unidentified human remains. Hornick said that it seemed like the laws were on track to be changed. But then, here comes obstacle number 8, COVID, which slowed everything down, including the legislature. In the fall of 2020, Commander Hornick enlisted the assistance of the FBI, which had a unit that handled investigative genetic genealogy. Hornick explained that if his department could get an ID, the way they got it was important, just in case this turned out to be a homicide. They wanted to be able to use the evidence and not have it suppressed because a New York State lab was not approved under New York State law. But a federal agency, the FBI, was not constrained to New York State laws and policies concerning familial DNA. So now we're at September 2020, and the bones were at the FBI lab in Quantico, Virginia. By this time, the bones had been stored for 41 years, and there was concern about degradation of the samples. About 6 months after submitting the bones to the FBI, in April 2021, the law in New York was changed, so Hornick was finally able to submit the case to the New York State lab. But, obstacle number 9, the state rejected the case because they did not have a sufficient sample to test under their guidelines. But a few months later, in October 2021, Hornick gets a call from the FBI.
I got a call from Special Agent Giordano of the FBI, and she said, we have our first lead. You know, we did the charts, you know, we're at fourth cousins, we're moving the tree up, we have a lead. And of those branches of the tree, we have found a family member who is in their 80s that's still alive. Everybody else in our charts right now is deceased. They're out in Massachusetts. The FBI was willing to send agents out to this location just outside Boston and interview a lady in her late 80s. And basically the purpose of that interview is, you know, that strange knock on the door of, hey, we're the U.S. government and we're following up on this DNA hit. And somehow you're related to the person, but we don't know exactly how yet, because, you know, we weren't able to get that exact kinship ratio of what the relation was. We just knew they were a close relation. That lady in her 80s, that was the first time we ever heard the name of what would later become confirmed as our John Doe. She said, well, this sounds like my nephew, Franklin Feldman. Nobody in our family seen him in 50 years. And that fit everything.
The relative said that Franklin had some mental health issues and was in upstate New York at one time, but that no one had seen him since the late 1970s. This relative also said that Franklin Feldman's mother had passed away around 2013.
Then the agents asked if she'd be willing to submit DNA for comparison, and she agreed. So at that point, our job was to try to fill in the rest of the blanks in the family tree. And now that we have a name for the first time, you know, we started this case or restarted this case in October of 2013. Now it's October 2021, 8 years. We're like, holy cow, let's see what we can do with this name.
Now, 8 years after Hornick resurrected the case, and 40 years after the body was discovered, they had a name. But they didn't have a date of birth or social security number for Mr. Feldman. Hornick contacted Massachusetts authorities, asking them to check their old files for any contacts with Franklin Feldman. Police located obituaries for Franklin's parents, which led them to a social security number and birth date for Franklin himself. It turned out that there were no earnings reported under Franklin's social security number, and as Hornick checked into driver's licenses and other official records, he was not finding that any state agencies had contact with Feldman. Hornick explained that, for the first time in his law enforcement career, having agencies tell him that they found nothing was actually a good thing.
Because by them not having any information was proving to me that Franklin was deceased.
Then they located a first cousin in his 70s in Massachusetts. The cousin had never met Franklin Feldman, but had heard about him from other family members. That cousin also volunteered a DNA swab, and once again, Commander Hornick waited for the lab. The lab came back with a kinship ratio, the likelihood that one person's related to another, that fit the family tree that they'd been building. John Doe, who probably died in January 1981 and was found in April 1981, was Franklin Feldman.
At that point, we were pretty much convinced this was him. The DNA got us there, the lady spontaneously saying it, the lack of information, and then it was just waiting for those samples to come back. One the FBI did, and the other the New York State Police Lab did. So we had them done at two separate labs, and the labs basically returned that this kinship ratio of this individual to your John Doe would be this. And in the one case, it was an aunt, and the other was a first cousin, and it matched exactly what our family tree was. It was really those two DNA swabs was our confirmation.
Commander Hornick's original goal was to set this case up for the next detective, but he also realized that if he didn't solve the mystery of the man's identity in the next 5 or 10 years, that it probably wouldn't get solved, considering that most family members would have passed away. And for all of the missing persons that Hornick scrutinized, looking at over 17,000 entries and hundreds of pages of documents, he was never going to find Franklin Feldman, because he was never reported missing. Police still don't know how Feldman died, but here's what they do know. Hornick said that Feldman, who would have been in his early 30s when he died, was on hard times and homeless, which matched up with some of the papers and telephone numbers that were noted from the scene in 1981. And they suspected he died in January 1981, a harsh winter month in upstate New York. The circumstances of the man with no name captured the attention of the Bethlehem community in 1981, and again in 2021, when Franklin Feldman was finally identified. And that corner of the farm where Feldman's body was discovered has been associated with that incident since Lynn Dente's grandfather found the body more than 40 years ago.
Whenever we refer to the back corner of that field, we refer to it as Dead Man's Cove.
Police were faced with a number of obstacles in this investigation, and Commander Hornick could have easily given up on this case. But for him, every person matters. The man who was buried in a pauper's grave in Albany County now has a name. And the family members who never really knew him but knew of him now know where he rests. Again, here's Linda Hayner from the dental office where the jawbones were located.
I often wondered about the families of whoever the victims were. The doctor that had the practice, he wrapped them up just like they were a dental case that he was going to send to a lab. And I think that's one of the reasons they lasted as well as they did, because he just packed them up like he would any lab case and then stored them there whenever they wanted to come back and get them. So I was very happy to see Adam. He made me very happy to know that some of these people might get closure.
The now retired Commander Hornick told me that this case ranks as one of the most rewarding in his career. He said that, in terms of magnitude, to go from nothing to having a DNA profile in 5 years, and then solving the mystery of the man's identity 3 years after that, was an amazing feeling.
The biggest part of this is really, to me, is how many people this case touched and will continue to touch into the future. And that's what meant the most to me.
The current Bethlehem Police Chief is proud of the work of her department in this investigation, especially the persistence of Commander Adam Hornick. Here's Bethlehem Police Chief Gina Kosciara.
So with some ingenuity and determination, you know, they just kept plugging at this case to try to resolve it for the family and just for the mystery of the case in the town that we had an unsolved death. You know, he did a great job with his team to work through these obstacles and finally come out to a great resolution of identifying the remains.
This case forged the way for other law enforcement agencies in New York State to be able to use genetic genealogy to help identify human remains. Again, Chief Gina Kosciara.
You know, it was a great undertaking to get that law changed so that the state and national databases could be used for that purpose. And that's what really ultimately ID'd this individual.
And while police are happy that they solved the identity of their John Doe, there's still no official cause and manner of death. The case remains open at Bethlehem, New York PD. And they encourage anyone who may have information or who may have known Franklin Feldman at the time to call detectives at 518-439-9973.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.